Don't make me activate your negative space.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Dan.
And this is the Concept Crucible Podcast.
Allegedly.
And today, we are digging deep into some genres or areas of literature, because Dan is here, and we're going to talk about books. Mm-hmm. So, icebreaker. Ryan, what is one of your formative books? We do this every time we talk about books, and it's never going to get old.
Yeah. We're always going to be forcing me to try to think of books and then try to limit it down.
Oh, it's so great.
That's why he's going first, is because I'm still thinking.
But, so, mine's technically not one book. Sorry.
He's not sorry.
Two answers for everything.
No, it's one answer. It's just, it's a series of books.
All right.
But if you're going to talk about formative books with young Ryan... The whole of the Calvin and Hobbes series.
Ooh.
That's legit.
I may have come across this in a weird way. Like, it was the book that I always brought into the bathroom with me, and that's where I ended up, like for an hour sitting there reading Calvin and Hobbes as a child.
Young Ryan's been pooping for an awful long time!
Yeah. But, when I think back to, you know, like, young Ryan... So, it's... Calvin and Hobbes is one of those... one of the stories, and I'm going to say story instead of a series of comics, because really it was written episodically and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's one of those stories that when I read it as a kid, it was funny because I related to a 6-year-old with a stuffed animal, and I always wanted like my own imaginary best friend.
You can get one.
Yeah, they're really cheap.
I know.
Seriously.
But I always enjoyed the stories.
You can get one now even.
I enjoyed the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back to it as an adult, and I understood like the philosophical conversations, the funny adult humor that was built into it, it's one of those stories that, yeah, when you read it multiple times, you get the, especially at different phases of your life, you get those different things out of it. And so I came across it through the anthologies, and I have a bunch of them because I stole them from my dad. And occasionally I'll pick it up off the bookshelf, and I'll thumb through it, and I'll look at a couple of them. And it's just, it's one, it's so amazing. I can't quite put into words just how amazing it
is. So I will go out on a limb here.
Yeah.
And I will say that you didn't, in fact, steal them from your dad, and that your dad has bequeathed them to you.
He's not dead.
No, but he has given them to you.
Fair.
He's
still bequeathed.
Yeah.
Out of recognition that is a part of you growing up.
It could be. It could be. I don't know.
That's some, like, supreme dadsmanship right there.
Yeah, I don't know if it was quite that intentional as just me just stealing it.
I give your dad the benefit of the dad.
But, I mean, when you frame it that way, it does tug at my man emotions and makes me think of, like...
We have a word on the podcast for man feelings.
Cat's cradle.
Isn't it just feelings,
yes,
Jim?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is.
Yes. It tugs at my man motions.
Your feelings.
And like, suddenly...
Gets in the chesticles.
Yeah. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon.
So mine, I will give Dan some more time to think.
There's just too many options.
Mine harkens back to 9-year-old Jim. And 9-year-old Jim found a book in a bookstore. As one does. It was called Dark Sword Adventures. It's by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, and I think a couple of other people. Now, I had read the Dark Sword trilogy. In fact, if you look to your right, Ryan, and by right I mean left, because Dan is on your right, you can see one of the Dark Sword books on the shelf there. The first one, Forging of the Dark Sword. And the Dark Sword was it's a really weird, neat trilogy. I never read anything like it. Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, who would go on to write The Rose of the Prophet, Star of the Guardians, the Dragonlance books. Yep. They were most famous for creating the setting of Dragonlance and Dungeons & Dragons. And Dark Sword Adventures was like this secret indie Dark Sword book that I'd never heard of. And I was like, damn. And I got my hands on it, and I was like, this is going to be so cool. And I read the first half of it, because it was like short stories and stuff about the same world that the main trilogy came in. And I wasn't as into that at 9. I was like, no, I want to read about all the like characters that I already know. But I read it. I read it a couple of times. But the back half of the book had all these charts and appendices, and the charts were full of numbers and lists, and they're repeated over and over and over again. And they referenced names of things in the world, like kinds of magic, and, you know, sort of they had a caste system in the world, and it referenced the caste system, and there were all these rules that went along with it, and I kept reading it. It took 9-year-old Jim like 3 months of his life and the help of a friend who was also 9, whose older brother played D&D, to figure out that the back half of that book was a Dark Sword role-playing game. Now, to me, that was fascinating. I'd played RPGs on the NES and things like that, and then, you know, all the standard RPGs you play when you were 9 in the, like, late 80s, early 90s, like Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy and Dragon Warrior. And so I'd played all this. I loved role-playing games, and I'd heard about D&D, but I'd never really got into it. And then I was like, okay, how does this work? I tried to play it with a friend, but he hadn't read any of the books, so all of the terminology was just completely lost on him. Like, there was just so much weird magical jargon, and he had no context for it. So I was like, oh, damn, that's not working. So it took me a couple of years to really figure it out. But that was the first tabletop role-playing game that I have ever come into contact with. And that went, it went from there to playing Warhammer Fantasy at camp, to writing my own system because I couldn't afford books, and playing it with my friends, to LARPing in high school, which is actually where I met Dan, to running D&D and all kinds of other games, and writing my thesis and blogging and who knows what else. But my introduction to RPGs came through the form of a novel, and was undoubtedly formative to my entire existence. It is part of what makes me who I am, as weird and stupid as that sounds.
It's weird and stupid.
It's a little weird.
Maybe just because I know you. So.
Yeah, I mean, you can't imagine me any other way.
Yeah.
But, Dan, you've had a lot of time to think.
I have. And as I've mentioned before, at some point in either the distant past or future, I do find it very hard to answer this particular question. And so the one I was thinking about when you asked me was, I'm going to bust out an oldie but a goodie, The Tin Drum by Günter Grass.
Oh, got a copy on the back there.
Yeah. So The Tin Drum was one of those books. I didn't pick it off the shelf at random. I did pick the first Günter Grass book I ever read off the shelf at random. It was Local Anesthetic. I'm just like, I went through this phase where I'm like, all right, I'm just going to pick books off the shelf at random and let's see how it goes. And I read Local Anesthetic and it was okay. And what it did was encourage me to read more Günter Grass, at which point I picked up The Tin Drum. And it...
which is real good.
It freaking blew my mind in some ways that... it took me a long time to be able to quantify, and then I'm still quantifying, because it's one of those books that I have reread, I have gone back to, I have found parallels with in all kinds of other books from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Salman Rushdie, any kind of magic realism kind of sort of scenario. And so The Tin Drum is basically this story about a boy in... growing up in Danzig in like the early Cold War, so after World War II, and like anything that's got to do with Günter Grass, it takes place in that area of Germany / Poland that's sort of gone back and forth, and that has all this history and all this kind of craziness and all this stories. And the thing, it's about this boy who decides, as he's being born, he hears these moths drumming around a light bulb. And at that moment, he decides that he's a drummer. That's what his purpose is, and that's what he will always be. And he begins to drum. And so his parents buy him these drums. And throughout his life, he goes through hundreds of these tin drums. And at some point, he's like 3 years old. He decides he doesn't want to grow anymore. He's just going to remain small. But he doesn't want his parents to become suspicious. So he decides he's got to fake an accident. So he takes two big jars of jam and puts them under his arms, and he throws himself down the basement stairs. And so with the broken glass and the jam, it looks horrific, and his parents are terrified, and they understand that later when he doesn't grow, well, that was why.
Yeah.
When really, he just decided not to. So, I mean, the boy sort of has quasi-magical kind of awareness and quasi-magical powers. And there's these images upon images upon images. Like, there's this image of him hanging out under his stepmother's petticoats. Like, layers and layers of petticoats, and then there's Oscar. There's this fabulous image of a man eel fishing by taking a horse's head, a worm-ridden horse's head, and throwing it into the bay, and then pulling it out an hour or two later, and it's, like, writhing with eels, right? And, like, just this sort of magical kind of language, the power of images, and then just the history of Eastern Europe, sort of that idea that complicated histories have more than one side, and it's often not the expected side that you, when you look at a history of an area like that, you were sort of given an expected narrative in Western history, and that's the narrative you expect to see. But sometimes when you read books written by people in these areas, and Marquez is another good example of this, because he has all these Colombian narratives, which is North Americans we don't know and understand. And Grass is a controversial figure, especially sort of lately in the years before he died, because of his some of his involvement in what he did during World War II, or what he didn't do, and all this other sort of stuff. And so, as a German, sort of living in this Polish area, I don't know. There was so much I learned in there that I can't. Like I said, I'm having trouble sort of expressing it, because a lot of it is sort of happening on levels that
it's intriguing to me. So I read Tin Drum years ago at Dan's behest. I borrowed his copy and read it because
I will give it to anybody who'll take it.
Read this book, and I did, and it was really good. But the thing that I love about it, and like my sort of the part that really sticks out for me, is when Oscar is a grown man. Well, I mean, he's a man. He doesn't grow anymore. But he spends a bunch of time as an art model.
Yeah.
And the book takes a lot of time to talk about how his figure is sort of lumpy and small and misshapen and all of that. But he loves being an art model, and he carries himself with this sort of confidence, because his awareness and his sense of self is just vastly more than his physicality.
Yeah, and it always has been, and throughout his life, it's sort of, and it's often the case. So you'll have something like this that sort of I would classify as sort of a magic realistic kind of thing, where almost everything in the world is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Except you have one or two things which are different.
Yep.
And those things are often sort of key to defining what that story is about. I think the first magic realistic thing I ever read was The Man with Enormous Wings, which is about this otherwise ordinary man in a small Colombian town who was kept in a cage. And the only thing that is different about him is that he has enormous wings. And he's a very sad man. And sort of it's a story about captivity and what happens when you keep an animal captive and this, that, and the other. But it's sort of a good example. Like, everything in the story is perfectly normal, except that the man has very large wings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things, like as somebody who doesn't always feel at home in their body, it was interesting to read about Oscar. And he was so matter of fact about it.
Yeah. Well, and it takes you out of the real to see the real, right? Yeah. Like, it takes you one step away from reality, and just that one step is enough to sort of realize that, past all the magic and past all the wonder and past all the literariness of it, all the real issues are still under there. And that's the one thing that I've often responded to anybody who has criticized sort of Grass's politics or questions his sort of ideology. It's like, well, read the books. I mean, that's one thing. All you have to do is read the books. And as someone who's read basically every word he's ever written, you know, it's all that controversy, all that doubt, all that sort of self-tearing and self sort of that guilt and that sort of stomach-tearing two-ness that is Germany after World War II, right? That is that German identity is all in there, and it's sort of fascinating.
It's funny because it dovetails into our topic. We sort of thought about it, and each of us has an era or genre of literature that or books that we are fascinated with, and yours is early and mid-20th century.
Especially
like modernism and
Well, and in specific parts of modernism, I really enjoy Edwardian fiction, like British Edwardian fiction. I sort of have a fascination with these periods where the people living in them, like the world around them has completely changed, and the people living in that world are almost completely oblivious to that fact. And sort of then the authors use this sort of disparity to sort of push and examine what exactly is going on. A good sort of contemporary example of this is like a show like Downton Abbey, which is the same time period, Edwardian period, where this family in this rich upper crust family, their life is gone, their world is over, the way they live is completely irrelevant, and they are spending the entire show slowly realizing that that is the case.
Yeah.
And sort of my sort of go to example for this kind of thing is usually Virginia Woolf, just because sort of her work was groundbreaking as far as content goes, groundbreaking as far as feminism goes and women writers, but also groundbreaking as far as like content and how structure and how she expressed these sort of changes and shifts in sort of societal values and how she looked at class and mm-hmm. sort of empire and sort of this whole destruction of Britain as it knew itself. Like, I mean, after World War One, imperialism was over. They just didn't know it yet. And it sort of took them 40 or 50 years to figure it out. And I sort of like modernism in general for that sort of examination of the old systems and the new systems. And sort of there was, you have and you have a lot of modernists doing a lot of things that we now see as reprehensible. T.S. Eliot and some of these other poets had sort of fascist leaning, some of them. They did some, didn't said and thought some things that we sort of find reprehensible, but they made this artwork that was sort of very challenging and very difficult and very sort of intense, that took a lot of study and it took a lot of sort of consideration. So there's mm-hmm. got, you have a lot of metaphor, you have a lot of allusions, a lot of that kind of stuff, and it's harder to read now even than it was then, because we don't have the classical education that we've been
well,
common.
you don't have the context.
No, exactly.
But it's one of the things I love about that era of lit is the sort of slowness of it.
Yes.
You know, you read books like I'm trying to think of an example that isn't Last of the Mohicans, because it's the first one that leapt to my mind. My problem with Last of the Mohicans is that it is fantastically racist. It is not alone in that regard either. Moby Dick,
mm-hmm.
somewhat less racist. But like the pages between, you know, someone lifting a harpoon and throwing it.
Yep.
There's 70 pages in there, and it's a history of whaling and a taxonomy of whales and the uses for whale oil, the notion that whalers are the anointers of kings.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot, like
about the anatomy of whales. For one thing.
like there's this moment like in a contemporary book where you're like, and then he raised his gun and then he shot and the next thing, like you're keeping that pacing. Herman Melville's like, I'm going to let you finish this. But first, I'm going to take you to school about whales. Welcome to whale school. First off, whales don't travel in schools. They travel in pods. Do they travel in pods? Dolphins travel
so.
In pods.
I think so.
I think whales also travel in pods.
It sounds legit.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about books, not whales.
But, like, it's just... And it's that thing where it just takes its time. It has, you have all the time in the world. You know, partly because you don't have a huge publishing scene, so Herman mm-hmm. Melville's not competing with 10,000 other authors,
yeah.
all of whom are on your Kindle, et cetera, et cetera. Herman Melville's like, you might call this one of the great American novels.
Yeah. Well, and there are definitely problems with early 20th century modernist fiction. Like, there's, and sort of the most common ones that are sort of, you know, the patriarchal nature. So you get, like, your sort of your epics like Joyce and Hemingway, sort of all these sort of, white men writing sort of manly books about man things, and those you know, those criticisms are valid for sure, but that doesn't stop them from being good books. And part of the reason that Virginia Woolf, I think, is so important is because she was sort of a woman writing in that same time and writing the same caliber of writing and doing the same things and sort of facing that sort of same literary challenge. Another great example is Margaret Lawrence, who is mm-hmm. one of my favorite authors sort of ever. And you know, and you sort of address the racism. We had some really good conversations about Evelyn Waugh and Scoop, which, if you have ever read, I will regret saying this, I think, but no, I won't even say it. Anyway, it is. We read it. I read it. So it was. I was in a class. I went back to school. Everyone was sort of 10 years younger than I were, and they couldn't get past the racism, right? So the book is the book is racist. There's a lot of that thing going on, but they couldn't get past it. They couldn't get to the level of some of it was just sort of, I don't know what the phrase to use is, but racism indicative of the time period it was written. So there's that sort of base level that is in anything that was written at that time. But above and beyond that was Waugh poking and poking and poking at the British upper class and the British system and British colonial and just poking and poking. But they couldn't get past the fact that it was there to move on to why it was there and what it was about.
I would make an argument that we have a term for the ability to get past racism. White privilege.
I mean, sure, but...
but that is a topic for a different podcast.
But the point there is that you can't understand what the book is about if you're not willing to sort of understand the context within which it was written. And I mean, you don't have to understand it, you don't have to want to, and that's, as like I said, that's another, I'm aware of the criticisms of modernism, like as I read it, but I find that part of the challenge and the interest in modernism, right, is exploring those kind of ideas and seeing how they were explored at the time.
So Huck, you have little to no experience with modernism. I gave Huck his first modernist book tonight, which was Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
I probably have some experience with
it. I can just give you my copies of Gravity's Rainbow if you want.
Yeah, it's just I haven't thought about it, so I don't have anything intelligible to say about
it. So what is your theme or genre of choice then?
It was kind of interesting when we were talking about it, and you're like, I know what you're going to say, Huck. And
you were
not that far off from the mark. So you, like, broadly speaking, nonfiction, narrower self-help, but it's a subset of self-help, really, and it's a little bit more encompassing than the self-help books. I'm going to kind of put a label on it and say system deconstruction. It's kind of a cross-section of self-help, sociology, pop psychology. Like, there's certainly problems with it. It reminds me of... sadly, I don't have any of the names, but it's the story of World War II or something, and they wanted to figure out how to reinforce their bombers in order to ensure that the bombers always made the right... or always came back from the runs, right? Because, like, you can't arm the entire bomber because then it's too heavy to fly and it's too slow. But you can't remove the bomber's armor because then they'll crash. And so for the longest time, they would take a look at the bombers that came back and then put armor plating wherever the bullet holes were. And some economist or whatever is like, why are you doing that? They clearly came back. You need to look at the bombers that didn't come back and see where those bullet holes are and then reinforce those areas.
Robert McNamara tells a story like that in Fog of War.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be that the story that I got it from was pulled from there. So, obviously, there's going to be... You have to have some sort of skepticism when you read the story of successful people and the recipe for success that they used, because mm-hmm. there might not be a universality to it. It might just be a confluence of luck, right? Sometimes it's a little difficult to run an experiment to test for those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, but I still think, and it's the same with in the last podcast where we talked about formative books, when I talked about Theodore Roosevelt, that when you take a system, in this case I'm going to use system broadly, and kind of try to break it down into some basic constituent parts and then play around with those, I think there's some value to that. So when I read a self-help book, a system deconstructor, I don't read it as a literal guide on how you ought to do something. I treat it more like if I were to collage and I would cut out the parts that I like and paste them all together. It's kind of like stealing from authors. You know, great authors steal from other people. So I'll take a little bit of this system and a little bit of this system and I'll try to work it in. And if it works for me, I'll keep it. And if I don't, I'll jettison it or I'll forget it because it didn't stick enough for me to remember to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as I rail against books like Outliers by Gladwell or networking books or whatever, I still find value in that case study approach. And Gladwell does that really, really well. He makes the stories really, really accessible by taking these case studies and trying to break it down into something that's, you know, the cause is something that you didn't think of, like the hockey kid or the children in hockey example. Have you ever heard of that one?
No.
The idea that if you look at a cross-section of hockey players, there's a disproportionate... Like, okay, if you were to look at hockey players, how would you expect their birthdays to fall?
I have no idea.
Well, randomly.
You think randomly, but disproportionately, they're clumped around a certain three-month grouping.
Huh.
And it all depends on the cutoff dates.
For like, peewee hockey?
It starts in hockey and it goes all the way up to the pros. And you look at any sporting level where they have cutoff dates for the ages, and you'll see the same grouping that the day after the cutoff, more of the kids are going to be born in, like, the first month, then a little bit less in the second, a little bit, and then there's a really small smattering. And the when you spot that pattern, you realize what's going on. The kids born the day after those cutoffs have an entire extra year of physical maturity to develop to become bigger and stronger than their peers while still being the same age.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then those bigger kids get more coaching. That coaching kind of stacks on top of each other. And suddenly you have hockey all-stars who have natural talent, but it's not really natural talent. It is you happen to be born and you happen to be physically larger than your peers, and then you happen to get more attention from coaches.
And then when one of those kids actually does have natural talent, you got frickin' Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, well, and in his book, in Outliers, he tries to make the argument there is no real, like, natural talent. Almost any instance of natural talent comes from hard work and deliberate practice and whatnot. So nobody, like Mozart, was a child genius, but he also had a lot of practice under his belt before he was discovered. He kind of put in his time behind the piano or composing and whatnot behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of stories I tend to gravitate towards, and other things like Jim Collins' Good to Great, where they take really successful companies and they break down where that success came from, you know, the hedgehog concept versus the fox. The hedgehog does something really, really well, in this case, balling up into a ball, where the fox tries to do a lot of things really well, but the hedgehog usually succeeds more because it can do that one thing really well. Anyways.
That's when you roll the hedgehog into a river. How you get the hedgehog to unroll.
Yeah, no.
I learned that from G.W. Burgess.
No, it's totally
friends
true.
Of the forest, motherfucker. Right here.
There's often going to be a kryptonite for that one really good tactic. But it's like, yeah, Jim Collins is Good to Great. Never Eat Alone. Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
That's a classic.
Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. John C. Maxwell, The Laws of Power. No, that's a different guy. He did, I read Intentional Living recently. So, like, all these books, they lay out systems where the author...
You really are Lawful Ryan.
They lay out systems that, you know, seem to make sense.
These books drive me crazy.
Yeah, I can understand how. And the one thing that, so a lot of my other buddies who will, we do try to have like a mutually improvement society mentality of trying to push each other to do really well. One of the things I often get criticized about is I read a lot of books or I read a lot of blogs or whatever, but I never translate that reading into action. And it's the one downfall of like the self-help books is there is a lot of really good ideas, but those ideas don't often get translated into building better habits where you actually put those good ideas into practice.
I have definitely read some of those blogs and flipped through some of those books, and I can safely say that I have adopted basically none of those habits, except that I will, after the fact, be like, Oh, that would have been really useful.
Mm-hmm. I've done that.
Oh, now I feel like a garbage human. Why am I such garbage? All I had to do was learn this lesson that I deliberately set out to learn. And I don't learn those lessons anymore. I don't read those lessons because I don't learn them, which is a terrible and self-destructive cycle.
See, I find those books useful for, like, if I'm learning a specific thing. Like, I'm learning how to do a specific thing, I find specific logical books like that useful. But as far as, like, and one of my views is all books are self-help books.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, especially, like, when I read a book that I'm going to get something out of, I like to be able to have to pry it on myself. Right. I'm just one of those persons that if it's going to make me a better person, I feel like I need to do some work to in order for that to stick. And it's always subtle. The stuff I gain and the stuff I grow when I read a book is subtle. And I don't even often realize it till years later. And I pry it out myself, and that's how I kind of like it. Mm-hmm. So those sort of books where they tell me how to be a better person, I get a little indignant. I don't need them to tell me how to be a better person. I'm going to go out in the world and figure out how to be a better person. But but you know, if they'd phrased it in a different way, like, because the stories you're saying, like the thing about the airplanes and the thing about those statistics in hockey, like they're really thought-provoking. And when I think about them, I come to some conclusions that are probably the same conclusions they're going to tell me.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I just resent having it rammed down my throat. I don't know.
I would actually make an argument that those books are not telling you how to be a better person. As somebody who spent two entire degrees learning how to tell people how to be a better person, what those books are instead teaching you, because they're not telling you like what is best in life. They're not teaching
how to be better at something, or
what they're trying to teach you is how to be better at the skill of person.
Yeah,
you know, and there's a distinction I think between being a good person and being good at personing. Mm-hmm. I think everyone within the sound of my voice knows someone who is quote unquote good with people, who they would never ever ask to help them to move.
I'm terrible at personing, but I mean, I'm an all right person.
it's one of those, and having someone help you move, of course, being the core thing that good people do. Good people go around and help other people move because it involves struggle, which is purely for the sake of others.
That's why there's a hilarious Seinfeld episode about that exact thing, because they're all terrible people.
Nobody wants to help anyone move. No. You do so because
I want to help Jim move because I owe him several times over.
But that's exactly it.
But it's because I owe him several times over.
Yeah. Well, I like helping people move.
So just to cap off the section, sure, before we move over to your genre-tastic section, the way I view it, contrary to what maybe some of the authors, the way they emphatically might suggest that there's only one way to be a better person, or to be better at your finances, or to be a better lover, be a better man, whatever the topic of the book is, I never assume that premise to be true, that this is the one authoritative view of how to be better at X.
I always see those emails that tell me how to be a better writer. They want to, what was it, make your pen is bigger. Like, the grammar's terrible. Yeah. But
the way I view these as, it's giving you a showcase of tools, a selection of tools that you select and put into your own toolbox. Because for me, when I think of myself, I think of myself as fairly ignorant, lazy, stupid, all these like really negative things.
Very uncharitable.
It's very uncharitable. But the thing is I overcome that through trying to instill good habits and putting systems in place where it removes the options, or it removes my ability to be lazy. So like going to the gym, instead of making a conscious choice to go to the gym, it's an automatic response of like, I come home, I do this, then I go to the gym. Mm-hmm. When I want to like read books or whatever, I commit to, I have to read one page. That's it. On some days, I only read one page. More often than not, I read more than one page, and I get that reading done. I commit to 30 minutes of studying. I put these systems in place because I don't trust myself to make decisions because I'm always tired, cranky, hungry, horny, anything. There's always a reason to not do or accomplish something.
Hungry is a legit reason.
Hungry is a legitimate... Like, there's so many times when it's just like, ah, man, I need a Snickers, otherwise I'm just a horrible person.
Because you don't want to get hangry.
I don't want
to
be hangry.
Welcome to Wutsu Riot, where we are broken men. No, yeah. Actually, it reminds me, when we played Battle of the Bards, they asked me for two sentences of intro to introduce the band. And I said, okay, give me a second to think about it. And they gave me one. And I settled on, here at Wutsuit Riot, we're a YouTube channel where we make each other braver on the internet. And I believe you've just encapsulated some of that and why you're here.
So that is why system deconstructing is something that I gravitate towards.
Your cord is a relic. And Jim.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dan, for that complete non sequitur.
Non sequiturs by Dan.
That's our new video series coming up. You can see that whenever we manage to make it. So mine is unsurprisingly science fiction. Yeah, no kidding. I write about science fiction books at Matter at Lab.
Have you notified Australia?
No. But yeah, it is not a, really a shock to anybody. But I read a lot of fantasy books too, and I have a lot of both. But it's for a sort of a weird reason. I mean, I think about science fiction. I used to be into it for action and technology and that kind of thing. But more and more, the thing that interests me about sci-fi is the sort of story of potentiality that's there. Lots of sci-fi that's about people, or like specifically humans, isn't just about exploring space or achieving great technological things or creating technological dystopias. It's about sort of trying to use technology to become the person you were supposed to be. I mean, in the same way that fantasy, often when you get into fantasy books that have prophecies or ancient history or things like that, it's the notion is that you're telling the story to realize the person you have always been. And they mix that a lot. Like this isn't a hard and fast genre. A good example of sci-fi employing that kind of trope is Battlestar Galactica. The new Battlestar Galactica show has a prophetic fantasy theme, which I have arbitrarily put in the realm of fantasy. But it is the whole point of those of the drama in those characters is to reveal not who they can become, but who they have always been at their core. And it sort of throughout the show strips them down until they are naked. And that's often where they find their power. So there's something very fantastical about that. But the science fiction stories that draw me in are those people who try and change and become. And specifically through technology. Shockingly, technology is a big part of my identity. Spoilers, I'm the one that edits all of these. It is part of who I am. And I'm drawn to cyberpunk fiction, you know, Snow Crash and stuff like that, which is all you know, Shadowrun. It's all about people sort of changing and augmenting their bodies and minds in order to become more. I mean, you get into the darker side of that with literally every story ever told by about super soldiers, not by super soldiers. Those are different sets of stories.
I wonder what kind of books Steve Rogers would write.
Probably really banal children's books. Be like, you know, Iron Man's like, yeah, I wrote 3 novels on physics. Steve, what have you been up to? I wrote a book about a bunny. Why would you do that? Because I was in the war and I wanted to write a book about the bunny. Oh, okay.
The same thing happened in modernism.
But Jesus.
I'm just saying.
I know, like it's I mean, you get all these stories in video games, especially about so and so started a super soldier program, and it's like the cheapest trope in shooter video games of blah 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 super soldiers blah blah blah, now they're tearing up tanks like paper and you have to fight them all with your guns. But I mean, that's that story of technology gone wrong. It's technology that tries to make people better, and it imagines that one of the things that it's predicated on is that notion that how we are now is not the way we are supposed to be. It's not the way we are meant to be. We are meant to be better. There's a line from Babylon 5. I wrote a post about it, actually. Words of Power post years ago. I'll dig it up for the show notes about it. Delenn was the character who said it. Or who was said about, rather. And it was that notion that to her, we are more than we think we are. We care more. And it's this idea that advancement isn't just, you know, metal limbs and enhanced cognition. It's improved empathy. It's a better understanding. It's stronger connectivity. Like it's the notion of improving your relationship with others as well as anything else. And I find it fascinating. Like that, but the story of that is in essence a story of alienation. Hmm. You have to be, that story only works if you feel alienated now. There's that Jonathan Coulton song, The Future Soon, which is a funny story about robots, but the line that always hits me is the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away. And it's this idea that through technology he will fix himself because he feels broken or flawed. And whether you fill those flaws with lead or with gold, they will make you whole. And ideally, in a far-off future, they will make you shine. And that is the thing I love about sci-fi, is that kind of weird-ass stuff. And often, like the if the Dan Fun version of a book is a book that you have to like dig into and extract the meaning from, the Jim Fun version is where you're just given this book and you have to make up your own meaning. And I find that meaning in stuff. And I really like it. I mean, whether that's deliberate, like books about Shadowrun or Dr. Sleepless was a really good comic series about that, also by Warren Ellis. Because I don't think I'm allowed to talk about comic books that aren't by Warren Ellis on the podcast. I think there's a... I think I signed a contract way back, possibly with the devil.
I didn't sign anything.
But
I don't have anything to say.
Yeah, but there's this notion of you know, sort of failing forward and changing as quickly as you can until you reach not even perfection, but better.
Mm-hmm. At some, like, I used to read more science fiction than I do. Mm-hmm. And there's at some point I just...
You succumbed to the spell of 20th century modernism.
Well, no, I just... There's a point at which I find science fiction to be unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was something about it that it isn't meaningful enough. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's... The thing I like about it is that potentiality that you talk about, where we can talk about a future where we can... change things or make things better. We sort of joked while we were prepping this. Star Trek was an example we used.
Yeah.
And the joke was that Star Trek was about our shiny, happy future until Gene Roddenberry died, and then it got dark and interesting. But there's something about those sort of shiny, happy futures which always sort of... I don't want to even say ring false, but I'm just inherently suspicious of.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like to me like... And even the dark sort of dystopic... sort of futures that are more interesting, I also sort of find somehow less meaningful. Because no matter how...
Than our actual dystopic present?
Well, or no, or the horrible things that we have actually done, right? Like, there is no way any science fiction book, to me, could possibly be as thought-provoking or as compelling or as interesting as something about an actual tragedy or actual victory that actually, like, that humanity sort of has more experience with, or that is not necessarily real, but presumably, like, real-ish, like, that could happen, that's sort of more now or more mm-hmm. present, right? So no matter what kind of possible Holocaust you could imagine out in space in the future, no matter sort of how many sort of future humans or aliens or anything that you could kill off in some kind of horrible catastrophe that you could imagine, there's sort of no way that could possibly be more meaningful than any kind of, like, I mean, the obvious sort of example is the Holocaust, but even mm-hmm. something on a smaller scale. Like, to me, sort of fiction or ideas that sort of explore those things that we've actually done and take implications from those, or that sort of take place in things that are sort of actually present or were present and draw implications for those are just somehow, I don't know, they feel more meaningful. Mm-hmm. This isn't something I've sort of explored in any thought. I was thinking about it as you were talking, but
it intrigues me that there's a sort of focus on the tragedies of the past when there are so many tragedies in the present.
Well, yeah, or even the present, like things that are happening now.
But
the tragedies of the future
also
are
for another day and a darker day
or a lighter day. That's
But no, I think you're right. The thing for me about sci-fi, yeah, it isn't so much tragedy as it is sort of personal change.
Yeah.
And that comes in all kinds of ways, whether that's lessons learned or robot arms gained.
Yeah.
Also, I want robot arms.
I do not want robot arms.
I think they would be better than my regular arms.
I like my regular arms. They have hair on them that I can do this with.
Your robot arms could have hair on them, too.
I guess so. But this is satisfying.
As a final comment on this before we close it off.
Sorry.
That's the sound of Dan rubbing his arm hair at Ryan.
I feel like there's almost two different kinds of cases we're talking about here. Like, we're talking about watered-down versions of real tragedy and projections of problems that we haven't yet encountered, that we don't want to encounter, but if we could learn a lesson through, say,
literature. Yeah, using science fiction to solve future problems, that's sort of an intriguing idea, like, that I do like.
Like, it's the difference between describing a future Holocaust and describing a future robot uprising that Asimov was trying to warn us about.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, the idea of our ethics and laws are not able to keep up with the runaway technological innovation, as opposed to just...
That's our present now.
Well, that's a really good example, because you've got... this sort of idea that until science fiction writers wrote about it, it never really had occurred to anybody that there could be an ethical issue there, like AI and stuff like that. And yeah, once you sort of put science fiction into that kind of realm, then it becomes fascinating, and then it becomes real, because it's something that we don't yet have experience with, but we know that we will.
Yeah,
which is sort of interesting again. Yeah,
and AI. I mean, AI. Like, even talking about AI. Which is a whole other...
that's a whole other can of baskets of worms.
But it's that kind of thing that makes us come face-to-face with what makes us human.
Yeah. Yep.
And the acknowledge of other sentience.
I can't wait to read books written by robots.
I think you can read those now, actually.
Really?
Oh, there we go. The Policeman's Helmet is Nearly Perpendicular.
What a great title.
Book of poetry by Raconteur, I believe.
There we go.
He is a Turing machine.
I'll have to look it up.
How you gendered the Turing machine.
As far as I know, he identifies as male.
Oh, okay.
Most of my Turing machine experiences with Alice, not my niece Alice, a different Alice, who she identifies
as... if Alice is a Turing machine, female. She's doing a damn good
job.
Isn't
she? She's got arms and legs and everything.
She seems pretty human to me.
Oh, man.
Chinese room!
Shut up, Ryan. We're not talking about Searle on this podcast. We'll do a separate artificial intelligence podcast sometime in the dim, dark future.
Or the past. We may have already done it.
It's thinking meat.
It's the meat.
Soylent Green is people!
Dude, there aren't even any robots.
People!
There are no robots in that. You just ruined everything.
There's Edward G. Robinson.
If you would like to ruin us, you can find us on Twitter at Woodsuit or on Facebook. You can subscribe on iTunes or on YouTube. All of these options surround you. Hang out. Come and hang out.
Don't follow me on Twitter. 98% of my tweets aren't posted.
That seems fine. Follow Dan for his 2% of tweets, which are obviously...
no, follow Robert Drayton instead.
Also follow Robert Drayton.
Do it.
Who is Robert Drayton? We'll look at him later. Do it.
The Canadian Romantic. Look up the Canadian Romantic YouTube. Look it up. And after you watch the first 5 seconds of the first one and you feel super uncomfortable, take a deep breath and keep watching. Trust me. Trust me.
Oh, God. Trust Dan. I'm Jim.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Dan.
Stay genre-tastic.
I hate you so much, Ryan.
Yeah, genre.
Do you notice how we cleverly overlapped it over the outro so you can't even edit it out?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, what a dick.
I'm still dancing.